You are listening to The Tish with Rabbi Michael Knopf, a JCast Network podcast. For more information about Rabbi Michael Knopf, please visit mikeknopf.com. For more information about other JCast Network podcasts and blogs, please visit jcastnetwork.org.
Within the Maccabees themselves, within the Hasmonean dynasty itself, there is a number of divisions, mainly, you know, in the way that you hear in lots of other kind of monarchic dynasties. People who, you know, if you ever watch Game of Thrones, right, that's the Maccabees. Right, they're fighting with each other all the time for who's going to be able to be high priest, who's going to be able to be king. There are periods of relative tranquility and periods of tremendous infighting, but their rule only lasts for about 100 years and devolves pretty quickly to a lot of corruption and a lot of strife and a lot of infighting. They're not able to control the population of Jews who have a lot of different kinds of different disagreements between each other and with the leadership. They're not able to resolve their own internal divisions, and they're not really able to withstand some of the military threats that exist around them, including still remnants of Alexander's empire and the Persians. Not to mention, well, there's another major thing that they did that's worth mentioning because it's related to a later piece of the history that I actually have already talked about. So one of the things that the Maccabees did, especially early on, is engage in wars of conquest. They want to expand the borders of the land of Israel and of this commonwealth that they had. And they did that by, you know, engaging in what we would call wars of choice, wars of colonization, whatever you want to call it, against surrounding nations. And when they did it, when they conquered a piece of land, they would forcibly convert the local populations to Judaism. Okay, most of you in this room know enough about Judaism to know that Judaism itself has, welcomes people who want to convert to Judaism, but has never, in a really deeply engaged way, been a fan of proselytization, right? Of like going out and saying, "Hey, you should be Jewish," right? So imagine what Jews thought of a group of leaders who not only went to people and said, "Hey, you should be Jewish," but "Hey, you must be Jewish, or I'm going to ram you through with this sword," right? But that's exactly what happened, right? Almost in the exact same. I mean, it's amazing, right? We celebrate the Maccabees as these, you know, liberators for religious freedom, but what they really stood for in a lot of ways was, you know, the freedom to force my religion on other people, right? They ended up being just like the Greeks that they overthrew in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't mean to besmirch them. We're historians here. So, it is disappointing. I understand. You know, the Jews at the time, many of them thought it was disappointing. Even the ones who were supportive of the Maccabees, even internally to the Maccabees, thought it was disappointing, but that was, one of the groups of people that they conquered were known as the Idumeans, which is sort of like modern-day Jordan. The most famous Idumean descendant was a guy named Herod. Herod is, who I mentioned before, was a Roman ruler of the province of Judah who considered himself a Jew. Because he was a descendant of ancestors who were forcibly converted by the Maccabees. And many Jews considered him a Jew too, but many didn't because they didn't believe in the authenticity of forced conversion. So didn't really consider a Roman, but not a Jew.
What was the population? Was it 100,000, a million? I mean, how many are we talking about?
That's a good question. My answers wouldn't be great, but certainly probably closer to a million than 100,000. It was a fairly good sized population, and it's a fairly large tract of land that we're talking about, especially when they expand the borders. I mean, you know, really increases the population size. So the Maccabees are controversial and seed a large amount of Jewish division and foment a lot of internal division. And over the course of a century, they sort of disintegrate. Until finally, there's so much infighting that they make a fateful decision. Two warring factions of the Hasmonean dynasty invite a growing regional power called Rome to help arbitrate their dispute over the throne. And so Rome, this is just at the end of the Roman Republic. Okay, that's the time period that we're talking about. So just before Caesar, Julius Caesar, says the Caesar themselves, like, this is I'm not going to turn down this opportunity. So they says, sure, we'll come in and arbitrate your disputes, right? And they do. They end up ultimately playing both sides of the dispute between the Hasmoneans, and effectively take control of the province once the claimants to the Hasmonean throne kill each other or die out or rendered effectively powerless. The Romans take full control over the province. Don't officially annex it to be a Roman province yet, but install their own king over the province, which they make a nominally Jewish king. That's Herod is the most prominent of those rulers. Who will, you know, all the Romans really want is the strategic position if they were to need it, and taxes, you know, so a tribute to Rome. They didn't necessarily want to govern the population. They just wanted the money from the population, and they wanted, you know, the position. So they install their own king, but they make it a nominally Jewish king to sort of like give the atmosphere, the air in the Jewish population, like it was still Jewish political sovereignty. So they install Herod as a king, and Herod is a very aggressive king. He's aggressive in a couple of ways. The first is he's aggressive in terms of his let's call it Romanization of Judea. So he engages in lots of magnificent building projects, some of which you can still see in Israel today, or at least the ruins of which you can still see in Israel today. Amphitheaters and palaces and infrastructure and highways, and not insignificantly the temple in Jerusalem, which he magnificently renovates in marble and gold. And so he's known by some at the time as Herod the Great. Now, you know, if you study enough history, that in the ancient world, when you were called the Great, usually it referred also to how many people you killed. And Herod was also very good at that. Herod was a very aggressive ruler in that aspect too. He was brutal and autocratic ruler of the Jewish population, which was, I say this with a little bit of trepidation, but from the perspective of the Romans, definitely a good thing. And probably from the perspective of the Jews, even though they had ambivalence to Herod, probably a good thing too. Because like Herod or not, agree with his policies or not, if you're at the end of Herod's sword or not, he kept a sustainable peace for the most part among the Jewish population, which, remember, from even a century before, because of the reaction to Maccabean rule, there are a lot of seething and disparate factions among the Jews, many of which dislike each other on political grounds, but even more dislike each other on religious and ideological grounds, which makes it particularly dangerous, right? Because not only, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, we have, you know, differences of opinion on, like, tax policy. That's not what they had. They had, you know, this is what God wants or this is not what God wants, right? And so their divisions existed on those grounds. So Herod, being a sort of ruthless dictator as he is able to keep a brutal peace, but a peace nonetheless, among those disparate factions. Yeah?
Do these people just do they really follow the Torah, the Sabbath, and things of that nature?
Yes, but in different ways. Not only in different ways than we do, but in different ways from each other, right? Which is related to some of these divisions that existed among them, right? And I mentioned at the very beginning of the lesson two of these groups really kind of emerge at this time. Maybe two of the major groups, we could say, are the Sadducees and the Pharisees, right? So both the Sadducees and the Pharisees believe in the authority of Torah, and so therefore believe, say, in the laws of the dietary laws of Leviticus, right? But the Sadducees have a very, let's say, literalist reading of the Torah, which in some ways makes dietary laws more expansive, in some ways makes them less expansive than we might observe them. The Pharisees are a lot closer to the way we observe, or those of us who observe the Jewish dietary laws observe the dietary laws, in that they have a sort of interpretive read of Leviticus, which also in some ways makes those laws, as you literally read them, more expansive, in some ways makes them less. So I'll just give you an example, right? So three times in the Bible, you get the injunction, you shall not boil a calf in its mother's milk, a kid in its mother's milk, right? Now, you could read that very literally, right? Don't slaughter a baby goat and then put it in a pot with milk you just took from its mother, right? That's, I think, about as literal as you could take that, right? The Pharisees didn't read that passage that way. They read that passage much more expansively. They said, you know, the fact that it's written three times means that it not only forbids cooking, but also eating and deriving benefit from those kind of mixtures. It uses an example of a kid in its mother's milk, but what it meant was to use that example as a popular dish, but it meant like all meat and all dairy. And they go even further than that, right? Not only can you not, you know, so what do you define as cooking them together? What do you define as eating them together? It's more than just the act of having the, like, actual milk and actual meat in a pot together. It's, did a pot get used for milk yesterday that you want to cook meat in today? Does that count as cooking meat and milk together? So the Pharisees were very engaged in those kind of questions. The Sadducees less so, because they were more literal in their approach. My favorite joke about that issue in particular that I'll share with you, this is like rabbi joke number 49, is Moses is on Mount Sinai with God, and he's recording the Torah at the top of the mountain. And God says to him, "Thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk." And Moses writes it down and says, "Okay, all right, so that means no cheeseburgers." And God says, "No, Moses, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk." And Moses says, "Thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk." Okay, so that means you need separate dishes for meat and dairy. Gotcha. Okay. And God says, "No, Moses, a third time. Thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk." And Moses says, "Ah, now I get it. You gotta wait 6 hours after you eat meat before you can eat dairy." And God says, "Fine, Moses, have it your way." Into the average Jew in the population, are they strictly Sabbath observant? Are they strictly? Probably not. At least, certainly not in the way we imagine strict observance of those things. There was, like you have today, cultural Jews, right? Or what? You know, the rabbis who are the what end up being the leaders of the Pharisees, they call them Amei Haaretz, which is which means like people of the land, literally, but is sort of a polite term for, you know, ignorant people, right? Who are like, you know, like sort of like don't really know what they're supposed to be doing. So like maybe like kind of, you know, they'll eat, you know, they'll be like my friends who want to honor Passover, and so like eat, you know, BLTs on matzah, right? You know, so like they have a sense of like what they're supposed to do. They don't like really quite get it, right? So that's. Anyway, so there are a lot of Jews in that camp too. Either, you know, and there are other Jews who were, you know, much more let's call them, you know, Hellenistic, right? They're much more into Greek culture than Jewish culture. Yes.
I can understand why we can't eat shrimp and lobster and pig, because in those days it was trichinosis. And the seafood were in mess. But what has milk, meat and milk have to do with anything in Judaism?
Right, so I'm going to, it's a good question. Next week's class is on kashrut, so we'll talk about that then. All right. So there are all these different factions among the Jewish population. When Herod dies, it's like what happened in Iraq after the Americans overthrew Saddam Hussein, right? And this is not an argument in favor of Saddam Hussein, but what the Americans didn't realize is that when you overthrow a brutal autocratic ruler, you have to kind of know what's like brooding underneath the surface. Right, and what was happening underneath the surface in Iraq that Saddam Hussein was able to keep a brutal peace but a peace nonetheless, was horrible sectarian divisions among Sunnis and Shia and Kurds and, you know, all sorts of groups that hate the living daylights out of each other. And, you know, thanks to the British after World War II for, like, making Iraq, they, like, put, like, several groups of people that, like, couldn't stand each other in the same country and said, here's your country, guys. Like, have fun. Here's your country. Have fun with it. That's my British impression. So that's what happened with the Jews after the death of Herod too. Is you have this powerful ruler who dies, and there's a power vacuum, and there are now all these groups sort of like swarming to the surface that hate each other's guts. The Romans pick up on the fact that there are all of these. Factions, thank you, among the Jews that hate each other, and if they don't do something serious, the situation's going to get out of hand. So they install, they more or less formally annex Judea as a province of the Roman Empire, and install direct Roman rule, Roman governors over the province of Judea. So this drives many segments of the Jewish population up a wall, right? Because remember, they've fought wars for Jewish political sovereignty. On top of the fact that the Roman rulers that Rome installed were each more corrupt and inept than the last, virtually all of them. In the contemporary histories, not one is seen as, you know, a favorable ruler, keeping the peace and building prosperity among the Jews. They were all almost universally hated figures, some more than others, and some by different groups more than others. Okay, so remember. So I mentioned that there are groups. The Pharisees and the Sadducees, those are the two major groups. One of the major distinguishing features between the two is their view of whether there's an oral interpretive tradition to the Torah or not. There are other features as well. Sadducees tended to be much more aristocratic, much more wealthy, much more tied into the temple leadership, which meant that, by and large, they were much more supportive and tied to Roman rule. They needed Roman rule to continue to be wealthy and tied into the priesthood, etc. The Pharisees were much more ambivalent to Roman rule. Some Pharisees hated Roman rule. Some Pharisees supported Roman rule. Some Pharisees were just waiting for the Messiah to come and overthrow Roman rule. There was a lot of ambivalence. And remember, I mentioned about the Pharisees that because they had an interpretive tradition of the Torah, and because they prioritized that interpretive tradition through the transmission from teacher to student, that their leaders were primarily teachers, not priests, or not necessarily priests. And so there was a sort of a more democratic approach to Judaism. Anybody could be a master Pharisee. Anybody could be a rabbi. So that meant that it was a much more diverse group, diverse geographically, diverse economically. Right? There were poor Pharisees and there were rich Pharisees, which meant that they, again, were not as tied in directly to the power center of Rome. There was another group that existed at the time, another major group that existed at the time, that were known as the Zealots. There were kind of subcategories of the Zealots, too. There was one group known in Latin as the Sicarii, which were the dagger people, because they would wander the streets of Jerusalem with daggers stabbing Romans and Roman sympathizers. You know, it was nice times. It was like the Wild West. The Zealots had it was militant Judaism. We need to get the Romans out of here. We're going to do whatever, by whatever means necessary. There were some Pharisees who were Zealots. There were some Sadducees who were Zealots, although not many. But the Zealots were, had a sort of, a militant nationalist take on Judaism. There were a few other groups too. One is known as the Essenes, which was sort of a messianic cult that sort of rejected the intrigue of the time, and sort of retreated to the wilderness, built their own sort of like monastic society in the wilderness, eventually died out because a lot of them took vows of celibacy. It's hard to reproduce your population if you all take vows of celibacy. But we know a lot about them because we think that a group of texts that were found in some caves near the Dead Sea were likely their literature. If you ever heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that's likely written by this sect called the Essenes. So all these groups, the formation of them really kind of starts in the Maccabean period, but they really kind of crystallize under Roman rule, both as a take on Judaism, but also as a response to Roman rule, right? So, do we like Rome? Do we not like Rome? Do we want to overthrow Rome? Do we not want to overthrow Rome? Do we think that God is going to eventually overthrow Rome, God's self? Or do you think that we're going to, someone's going to give birth to a Messiah, meaning a rightful heir to the throne of Israel, and he's going to lead a rebellion against Rome, and we'll overthrow Rome that way. There are lots of different groups that respond to Roman rule. One of them I'm sort of beating around it by now, but you probably can take the hint. One of them are followers of a man named Jesus from a northern city called Nazareth. Now, what you need to know about Jesus of Nazareth is that he was not the only person in his time, either before or after his time, that people associated as being a messianic figure, meaning a person that was destined to take the throne of Israel and overthrow Roman rule. Jesus' movement was unique in that after Jesus' death, some Jesus' followers continued to believe that he was the Messiah and was going to come back again to overthrow Rome. That's really what made the Jesus movement unique, and there's some really interesting histories written about, you know, how that happened, where other messianic Jewish movements did not turn out that way, but I'm not going to really get into that history right now. What I want to say is that I think that there's pretty compelling evidence that suggests that that really all you need to know about Jesus is that whether or not he considered himself to be the Messiah, his followers did, and that was really all you need to know about why he was executed by Rome. Because a Jewish Messiah was a rebel. That was an act of insurrection against the empire. And crucifixion was the execution method of choice for people who rebel against the empire, because it was public, right? It was a warning sign to other would-be rebels that this is where that gets you, right?
What was he, a zealot?
So there's a popular book that came out last year or the year before that made the argument that he was a zealot. I didn't think that part of the book was particularly convincing, and there are a lot of interesting critiques of the, it's a good book if you want to read it. The guy who wrote it is a really good writer. His name is Reza Aslan. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Aslan. And the book is called Zealot. So whether or not he was actually a zealot, meaning like associated, affiliated with that group of Jews, I don't think that the evidence is so convincing. But did his, you know, was he likely executed by Rome for the crime of sedition, which was the punishment that was eventually given to a lot of zealots for similar ideas? Yes. Did his followers associate with zealots or have similar kinds of concepts? It seems pretty clear that they did. It's a little bit unclear from the Gospels exactly what Jesus thought of himself, although what you need to know about the Gospels is that none of them were written by contemporaries of Jesus. So it's all people after the fact, sort of looking back, and it's a complicated history with that. I can't get too much into it because I'm also not a scholar of early Christianity. Yeah, that's an interesting part of the history too. So it's possible, like I mentioned, there are groups of Jews at the time, the Sadducees in particular, who are very much supportive of and dependent on Roman leadership. So it's not at all unsurprising. It wouldn't at all be unsurprising if there were Jewish groups and Jewish leaders at the time who were turning over people suspected of sedition to the Roman authorities. So in that way, you know, maybe the Gospels are right. You know, I know that's because there's a lot of really hateful and destructive history that goes along with that association. And the authors of the Gospels, not having been alive, most of them at the time of Jesus. None of them were alive, were contemporaries of Jesus. I think only two of the four authors of the Gospels, if I'm not mistaken, were actually Jews. I'm not sure whether the Jewish authors or the not, I have to go back and actually look at the texts, were one or the other of those two camps, Jewish Allah, I can make an argument for Jewish Allah, they can make an argument for non-Jewish Allah, they might be more or less inclined to pin the guilt for Jesus' execution on the Jews for a handful of reasons. Not the least of which is, Rome's going to get a copy of your book, right? And if Rome doesn't like what you have to say in the book, then not only is the book not going to get out to the people you want it to get out to, but you might die in the process, right? So it was safer to pin the execution on the Jews.
Blame it on the Jews.
But it's important, I think, to understand, I'll call it the Jesus movement, or early Christianity, whatever you want to call it, as another Jewish sect that emerges as a response to Roman rule. Right? And as these Jewish sects emerge as responses to Roman rule, they not only respond to Roman rule, but respond to each other, and more often than not, they hate each other. Right, so there's a downward spiral that happens with Roman rule. Okay, Rome institutes direct rule; it sparks unrest among the Jews. Because there's unrest among the Jews, orders come from Rome to crack down more on Jewish insurgency and unrest. More unrest ensues because there's a response to the crackdown of Rome on the Jewish population, right? More unrest, more crackdown. More crackdown, more unrest. There's on and on and on with the spiral until it sort of boils to a head in 67, there's a full-on revolt of the Jewish population against Roman rule, which ends with the destruction of the temple in 70 CE. Okay? The destruction of the temple, as I mentioned before, effectively kills off several of these competing Jewish ideologies. It kills off the Sadducees, because the Sadducees, if you remember, are very much tied into a literal reading of the Bible, which necessitates a temple. And if there's no temple, there's no priesthood, and no Jewish worship, so the Sadducees basically have to either admit they were wrong all along about what Judaism is all about, in which case we can do other things and we might as well be Pharisees, or they had to say that, okay, Judaism is over, right, because the temple is destroyed. The Essenes, who live out, by the Dead Sea and are celibate, they're not really much of a hope for Jewish survival. The early Christians at the time of the destruction, well, first of all, the early Christians at the time of the destruction of the temple are still a very small movement. And not particularly popular because, if you are making an argument that your leader who has died 30, 40 years earlier, is going to topple the Roman Empire, but it looks like the Roman Empire not only isn't in any position to be toppled, but just toppled you, it's not a very compelling ideology to buy to, which is why, one of the major reasons why the early Christianity spreads much more quickly among non-Jewish nations than among the Jews. Most of Paul's ministry the 50s, I think it is, give or take, is to the non-Jewish nations. And his letters to the Jews in the land of Israel are much more defensive. So the last real surviving and survivable remnant of the Jewish population, Jewish ideology, is rabbinic Pharisaic Judaism, right? And it survives largely because it's portable, right? The temple's obviously a good thing, but the rabbis, the Pharisees, believed you didn't need a temple in order to worship. You could worship with a verbal liturgy in a synagogue outside of Jerusalem if you wanted to. Another way of accessing God was through the study of Torah and the oral tradition. And so you didn't need a priesthood to help you access God. And the rabbis weren't wedded to Roman rule, so they could say that we aren't supportive of Rome. Look at what they did to the Jewish population. But at the same time, even though there were some Pharisees who were supportive of the zealots and of the rebellion, they could say, you know, we're distant enough from this rebellion to say that we aren't responsible for the horrific destruction that just took place as a result of the rebellion. And they're democratic in a way, right? So anybody can be part of the Pharisaic rabbinic tradition. All you need to do is observe the commandments of the Torah, study, pray, etc. It's Judaism as we know Judaism for the most part. So they become the dominant and really sole surviving claimant to Judaism. And really, this is, you know, we often talk about Christianity is a daughter religion of Judaism, but it's really in some ways not a fair thing to say to Christianity, and overstating the case of Judaism, because both of them are kind of emerging from the exact same place and at the exact same time, and they splinter off at the same time, right? So you get Christianity going in one direction, more importantly for the Jewish population, Pharisaic Judaism going in the other direction. And you can't really trace back Judaism as we know it today further than this time period. I mean, this is really... So to say that Christianity is a daughter religion of Judaism, I think it's much more accurate to say it's a sister religion of rabbinic Judaism. The couple of centuries that follow the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple are tumultuous ones still for the Jewish population, and even for rabbinic Jews. So there are still periodically Jewish uprisings and unrests, some of which are supported by the rabbinic leadership. Most notably, the Bar Kokhba rebellion in 138, if I'm not mistaken, CE, which was the last major revolt, somewhat successful for a period of time, but ultimately brutally crushed by the Romans, resulting in a number of years of destruction and persecution of the Romans, and really, you know, like to the extent that they were willing to tolerate the Jewish population after the Jewish revolt in 67, after the Bar Kokhba rebellion. There's really no more tolerance in the Roman leadership for the Jewish population, and so there's in a lot of ways, a program to expunge Judaism from the land of Israel. They rename the province Palestine after the name of the Philistines who occupied part of the land of Israel during biblical times. They outlawed the study of Torah and other Jewish practices. They renamed Jerusalem Ilia Capitolina put a Roman temple to Jupiter on the site of the Temple Mount. There was a campaign to really kind of wipe out the memory of the Jewish population in the province, and with it Jewish religion altogether. So I say all that because sensing the threat that these new Roman policies were posing to the transmission and future of Judaism, and given the fact that rabbinic leaders were being persecuted and executed by the Romans for the crime of studying and teaching Torah, rabbis late second century CE decided to codify their oral tradition. It had previously been just that, an oral tradition. We don't write it down because it's an oral tradition. It's transmitted from teacher to student. They said, if we don't write this stuff down, we're going to lose it. And it's not going to be able to be transmittable to far-flung Jewish communities in the diaspora. So under the leadership of a Nasi, a rabbinic leader named Rabbi Judah the Prince, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the rabbis compile a book called the Mishnah. The Mishnah, which is, this is one volume of it, actually it's more like one volume of it, this is like half of one volume of it. The Mishnah is a six-volume work of basically rabbinic law, which is to say legal interpretations of the laws of the Torah. It's sort of a complicated book because it's not written like a law code, but nevertheless, it has it kind of takes thematically. Principles from the categories of laws from the Torah and kind of delineates the actual application of each of those laws. But it's interesting because not only does it codify the oral traditions of interpreting the Torah's laws, but it also codifies rabbinic debates about how to interpret and apply Torah's laws. So more often than not, in this text, the Mishnah, which is, I don't know if I mentioned, is a six-volume work. This is one of six. Crystallizes debates among rabbis and actually over the course of generations of rabbis about the proper interpretation and application of Torah's laws. And more often than not, not weighing in on who's right about in the debate, right? So there'll be a debate between Hillel and Shammai, or Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Joshua, and it'll say what the content of the debate was, but it won't say, you know, which is the right law to follow. Very often, yeah.
So what says what is the right law to follow?
Good question. So here, well, first I'm going to pass these around, okay? These are three different editions of the Mishnah. One that has English translation commentary, another that just has sort of like an academic Hebrew commentary, and the other that has a more like traditional Hebrew commentary. Just kind of so you get a flavor. Right? You know, if you're looking at the ones that only have Hebrew, you may not really get a sense of what's going on, but you can kind of just see what a page looks like. So that's codified around the year 200, the Mishnah. After the Mishnah is codified, it becomes the primary text that's taught in rabbinic academies, which are all over the Jewish world, which is not only the land of Israel, it's all over the known world at the time. What's that? Okay, that's fine, you can. As the major text of study in rabbinic academies, there begins to sprout any number of vigorous debates and conversations spanning miles and decades among rabbis and their students about you know, first of all, there's a difference of opinion recorded in the Mishnah, who's right. But not only that, some of the Mishnah is written in a way that kind of mimics the oral character of the tradition. So it's written in a lot of pithy statements and rhyme and meter, and it's really an amazingly written book. But what the problem with that, from a legal perspective, is you kind of like really have to know what the authors of that text meant when they wrote what they wrote or said what they said. So there are all these conversations that happen in academies and schools between teachers and students about whose opinion do we follow and what did they mean when they taught what they taught. And not only that, but is there other material and other traditions that for one reason or another got left out of that book and why, right? Because not everything made it into there. You know, things have to hit the cutting room floor, otherwise the book would be too long.
But in the academies, people knew some of these other traditions, and they said, but, you know, this was in the Mishnah, but wait, there's another tradition by the same rabbi who says the opposite thing, right, in another place. So why did that one make it into the Mishnah, but where he said the opposite thing, that didn't make it in? Maybe he was right there. The same rabbi said the opposite thing. So those conversations eventually get recorded in a larger book called the Talmud. Okay? The Talmud, it consists of two parts. There's the Mishnah, which it takes really just a snippet of text from this larger book called the Mishnah. A snippet at a time, I mean, of text from this larger book called the Mishnah. And then has another text appended onto it called the Gemara. Right? So Talmud equals Mishnah plus Gemara. Okay, so whenever you hear the word Talmud, that's what it means. Mishnah plus Gemara. Okay? Gemara are later rabbinic conversations about the Mishnah. Right? Including all those things that I just mentioned. You know, so who's right? What does this mean? Here's another tradition. Here's a story that this made me think of, right? Here's a joke that I heard. You get some of that, right? Here's some, you know, weird potion that I heard, you know, is good for sexual prowess. There's all sorts of stuff in the Gemara. Also arranged thematically by biblical principles. So the books, the volumes that I chose, I didn't choose by accident. As I mentioned, the Mishnah has six volumes. They're called orders. And each order is broken up into subcategories called tractates. Okay? So the order that is being passed around now is called Moed, which means fixed times, which is the section of Mishnah dealing with Shabbat and holidays. Okay? So there is a tractate within that order of Mishnah dealing with Shabbat, a tractate within that order dealing with Passover, a tractate within that order dealing with Rosh Hashanah, a tractate dealing with Purim, on and on. So this is one volume of the Talmud. This is just the tractate dealing with Shabbat. Okay? There's another basically equally sized volume dealing with Passover. Another equally sized volume dealing with Purim. Another equally sized volume dealing with Yom Kippur. Another, right, and on, you get the idea. Not every tractate of Mishnah has a Gemara, right? So not every tractate of Mishnah is in the Talmud, but most are.
So
is
it like a revision?
Yeah, how often is it updated? Like, whose last opinion was the opinion?
So the Talmud was, so there are two Talmuds actually. Of course, why does it have to be easy? So two Talmuds. The one that, when people say the Talmud, what they're usually referring to is the Babylonian Talmud. That's actually what I brought, the Babylonian Talmud. Babylonian meaning it was compiled in Babylonia, modern day Iraq. And it was compiled. The final editing, it's a little bit fuzzy, but let's say around 600 CE. Give or
take. Get past those.
She's still reading the book. Okay. Okay,
so the Babylonian Talmud was redacted around 600 CE. The other Talmud is known as the Talmud Yerushalmi, or the Jerusalem Talmud, sometimes called the Palestinian Talmud. That's an earlier Talmud. So that one was probably edited, again, the dates are somewhat fuzzy, probably edited sometime around 400 CE. So the reason the Babylonian Talmud is the one that we all know, there are two reasons. The first is, the presumption is that because it's a later text, it knows about what's in the Jerusalem Talmud and is an updated version of it, right? So it sort of is a better version of it. What's interesting, if you're like, you know, a geek about these things, is you can study them side by side and see what the differences are and talk about, you know, what the value is of the differences. The other reason is, and this is an important one, is that by the time that the Babylonian Talmud was written, the vast majority of the Jewish world lived outside of the land of Israel. And so the Babylonian Talmud was, you know, a book of Jewish law written by diaspora Jews for diaspora Jews. Right? And for most of Jewish history, we've been a diaspora Jewish people. And so we've studied the Babylonian Talmud, I think, largely because of that reason. But there's a resurgent movement now in Israel to start studying the Jerusalem Talmud more. Yeah, whatever.
So how many volumes of that actually make up the Talmud? How many books like this?
Well, you know, it depends on the edition you get, because you get some of the volumes broken up into others, but something like 20, 22 or 24.
So back to my question of why did they stop at 400? I mean, there's not been other thoughts.
Why did they... Like,
why did they say these guys knew it?
They didn't really stop. If you can see, I mean, you guys, if you have your course packet, you actually have a sample page of this. You can see, although it's a different one than I'm on, but you can see what I'm talking about. So you have the text of the Talmud is in the middle of the page here. This is the Mishnah and the Gemara. And that was codified at a certain time, but remember, they didn't have word processors with it. They couldn't, like, upload this into the computer, and, like, they didn't have a Google Doc where they could change it. It was already written. So what they did was, they had a tradition of commentary and interpretation this printing is a medieval printing known as the Vilna edition. This is a classic edition of the Talmud. And you put the commentaries all around the page. So everything that surrounds it here are commentaries. So this is on this side of, usually on the page closest to the margin, is Rashi's commentary. Rashi is an 11th century French rabbinic commentator, writes a commentary on almost every tractate of the Talmud, and also on the whole Torah, the whole Tanakh, I should say, and is probably the most famous commentator in Jewish history. Rashi's students are known as the Tosafot. They're usually on the opposite side of the page. So his children and grandchildren in France and Germany get their own part of the Talmud where they're responding to what Rashi says. There's Rabbeinu Hananel around the page. So there is a continuation of the tradition of the Talmud after the Talmud is written, just not embedded into the text itself.